Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What would it be like to live and work on the grounds of a British manor house like the fictional Downton Abbey? The series has already depicted changing times and their impact on such large domestic operations. But at the start of the 20th century, more people in Britain were employed as domestic servants than in any other occupation. And at the grandest of estates, there was literally no job too small to be passed off to a servant. From buttoning up employers' clothing to sanitizing their loose change, and almost no detail of servants' lives was off limits for employers to dictate. Author Lucy Lethbridge has researched this endlessly fascinating subculture and shares what she learned in her new book, Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Lucy, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
There was a time in British history where essentially one either had servants or one was a servant. How did household service become such a key feature of British culture?
Well, I think it had always been a feature of British culture. I mean, wherever there is money to employ someone else to do your dirty work, then there will be someone to do it because, you know, there is always labor available as long as there is poverty. But I think it became a sort of key feature of status in the 19th century and the growth of the what one might call the middle-class home, the sort of middle classification of the home. And it became very important to have signs that you didn't do your own dirty work. So uniformed maids became very common, uniformed butlers, that kind of thing. It's not as though there hadn't been servants in the past. There had been very many of them. But these very elaborate external signs of service really take root in the early years of Victoria's reign.
And it's interesting that middle class people really wanted this for themselves. So they would, I suppose, in most cases, the man would go out and work, and part of how significant a part of his salary would have gone to paying the servants.
Well, surprisingly little of it. I mean, depending slightly on where you sit. I mean, in Britain, the British middle class, which is enormous, and really pretty well everyone, is there are so many minute calibrations. So someone very lower middle class would find it a great stretch to employ a servant. Someone at the upper end of the scale, maybe earning, say, $10,000 a year, probably a private income, could employ 10 servants. And I found one budget, in fact, for 1900 that suggested that the employment of a household of 10 could cost you less than the keeping of four horses. So labor was cheap. Wages were cheap. Wages were not the largest expense that you had in employing servants. By far, the bigger expense was laundry for their uniforms and food, feeding them.
Where did you go for source material? Given at the time that these individuals were working, few servants would have been considered important enough to merit very much study. Maybe their salary was written down, but that would have been the extent of it, right?
Well, certainly there is not very much before about 1900, but there is a moment in 20th century Britain when people become very interested in working class culture, and then there's a sort of plethora of research, and there are archives here which have of working class autobiography, for example, and there was the growth of a state system that encouraged people to go back to night school and so on and write down their lives, has been an enormous resource for us. And it's absolutely wonderful because, I mean, the great thing about reading any memoir by someone who is not a professional writer is that you get this lovely, fresh voice and you really feel that you are there. It's very unpolished, but you feel that you're hearing life as it was.
And there were some cases, Lucy, of people going undercover to reveal what life was like.
Yes, there was a great... I think that in the mid-20th century, when there was a sense in which this world was disappearing, and it didn't last for very long, if you think it rose to the what we think of as the Downton Abbey kind of style of service, the uniformed maids, the butler, the footman, and so on, the servants' hall, that really flourished from about 1850 to 1950. So although it feels like it's a sort of... it's been part of the British identity for centuries. It's a blip. It's a tiny moment in British social history. And so I think by the 30s, before the Second World War, for a lot of young writers, they realized that they were looking at a world that was about to disappear. And so you get a spate of writers like Monica Dickens, who I'm sure many of your readers will have read One Pair of Hands, which is a wonderful account of advertising to be a housemaid and then writing a book about not so much what it is to be in service, but what it is to live in these sort of rather impoverished worlds of people desperately keeping up appearances. And it's the last gasp of a world, really, that has disappeared. Another of my favorites is Celia Fremlin, who worked for Mass Observation, which was a social research archive. And in 1939, she went to work as a maid for various families. And she writes these absolutely scorchingly funny accounts of extraordinary households. There's one old lady who has a staff of eight, all of which have to be mobilized to make supper, which consists of one cup of Horlicks, so Ovaltine, which is like a malted milk drink, and a single digestive biscuit.
Because there's so much ritual that goes along with preparing all these things.
Yes, and I think for a lot of women of that, the Dowager's generation, it was sort of unthinkable, first of all, that you had a duty of care to your staff, so you couldn't sack them during an economic depression. I think that's to be remembered, that a lot of people kept servants that they couldn't afford because they felt they couldn't sack them. And the other thing was that the servants themselves, there's a sort of, for those old career servants like the ones you see in Downton Abbey, there's a sort of dignity of skill. There's a great deal of craft. There's a great deal of management learnt by Mr. Carson and Mrs. Hughes. There's an enormous amount of skill learnt by Mrs. Patmore. So even if you're asking them to do very little, it's a sort of upholding of the dignity of the work.
Yeah, and I think it becomes very clear watching this series, and we'll talk about your overall impressions in a moment, and remind you as well that you're a season ahead of us here in the U.S.,
yes.
So no spoilers.
I won't.
People took pride in their work, and I'm sure that there were people who were disaffected, and we've seen shades of that on the show, but there were people who felt as if this was their calling.
Well, I think certainly to be a career servant. I mean, it's very hard, as it is with all human beings, it's very hard to draw complete generalizations. I mean, the impression that I got, to be very broad brush about it, was that for men in service, they took a great deal more pride in it often than women did. I mean, for them it was a career. There's a certain temperament that is very suited to it. A lot of men who'd been in the army liked the order and the discipline and the hierarchies of a big country house, somewhere like the figure of Bates, for example, would be very typical. Someone who'd been a Batman in the war and had lived alongside an officer has no problem with the sort of hierarchies that are involved and the disciplines. And even today, former servicemen are very in demand for that kind of managerial domestic service. And a butler at the top of his game could earn as much as a bank manager.
Hmm.
But for women, it was different, because mostly for women in service, you didn't get to be Mrs. Hughes. You lingered on in some rather cash-strapped middle-class household as a maid of all work, and your only escape from that was marriage. So there was a very big difference there.
Yeah, why were people like Mrs. Patmore and Mrs. Hughes addressed by that title when, by and large, they were almost never married?
Well, I think that it gave them the sort of gravitas.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was considered a sort of honorary thing. I mean, for us, it's hard for us to see why being a Mrs. would give you more gravitas than being a Miss. But I think in those days, to be a Miss, it was a sort of obvious indication of spinsterhood at a time when women were supposed to be married.
Mm.
I think it was considered to add dignity to the job.
So you mentioned, Lucy, that people would stay loyal to longtime servants even when times were economically tight because they felt a sort of responsibility to them in many cases. I suppose what a career servant traded for that kind of security was a great deal of independence.
Well, of course. But I mean, we're talking for most of the time about a world before the welfare state, what we in this country call the welfare state. There's no social housing. There's no unemployment benefit. I mean, there wasn't actually unemployment benefit for domestic servants for a long time after it was introduced for other trades. So you were very, very dependent, both financially, and then I think as the years went on, emotionally to your employer. I mean, my own grandparents had a cook who came to them in 1927. She was about 10 years older than them when they first married, and she was still with them when they died in 1982. And they were three very old people in their 80s living together rather fractiously. but with, I think I would say, great love, because I think proximity develops love in homes that are open to it. And so you, I think that is the other side. That is perhaps the side about which we feel nostalgic, is the sense of a sort of cobweb of dependency that grew up around these relationships. Not very often abused, of course.
Yeah.
But also very often not.
What kinds of barriers were set up to prevent contact between, social contact between servants and their employers?
Servants and their employers?
Yes.
Well, I think it would depend on the house in which you lived, but I think there comes, in the 18th century, households were very big and sprawling, and most people lived on the same floor. And certainly it would have been not uncustomary for servants to have shared a bedroom with their employers. I mean, there would have been very little distinction. But this thing I talked about earlier, this sort of middle classification that comes about in the mid-19th century, that changes everything, because the idea of the family, exemplified by the family of Queen Victoria herself, becomes the sort of sacred thing, and the idea of the privacy of the family, the inner sanctum, becomes all important. And so to that end, even architecture begins to reflect the keeping of two communities under one roof. And we've talked about the uniforms, for example, that mark the maid from her employers, so that you're not under any illusion when you go to someone's house that the girl who opens the door is no relation. She's not part of the family. She is different. And the same, and so architecture itself reflects this whole new idea of backstairs, servants' wings, long corridors, basements with service steps, tradesmen's entrances, all these things which cause an almost physical division between the master and his staff. And that was relatively new. That would be something that the 18th and 17th and certainly the medieval household simply wouldn't have really have understood.
So I suppose in the 19th century, it's almost as if servants were like ghosts, right? They were there, but they were to do what they had to get done without making themselves obvious.
Yes, it's a very odd, because I call it in my book, I call it the sort of invisible visible, because servants, very important for servants, certainly front of house servants, to be very on display, you know, the footmen wearing these increasingly absurdly peacock-like liveries, you know, the sort of breeches and braid and gold everywhere. And yet, at the same time, the requirement that everything should be done but never seen, so that rather like a very, very grand hotel now, I suppose, would be the only example we might ever experience that kind of thing, where you know, the cushions are always plumped by unseen hands that always make sure the soap is new and the sheets are changed. So there's this constant desire for order, and by which you never see the workings, the cogs of the home. You never see the engine.
My guest is author Lucy Lethbridge. Her new book is called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Thank God on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Lucy Lethbridge. Her new book is called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Lucy, how did it happen that members of the elite classes in particular came to be so entirely helpless, and what did they do with all the time that they weren't spending selecting their own cufflinks and opening the window for themselves?
Well, I suppose, like everything, that rather depends on temperament and education. But, there were commentators that said that the British aristocracy were hopelessly idle. And they did nothing but read sort of tabloid newspapers and go to musicals, music halls, I should say. Mm-hmm. And there was a stereotype of the sort of indolent youth. But of course, the other kinds of upper classes that went into government and so on would say that they were, and this of course is a long-running question about domestic service even today, is that in order that they should have the leisure to work hard on the great issues of the land, they would need to have, they would need to have someone bring them their hot water and shave them and all these things. But I must say, I was staggered in my researches. I hadn't realized the extent to which what happens if you have a huge staff doing absolutely everything for you is that you really are left with no practical skills whatsoever. And the level of sort of incompetence was often remarked on by Americans who married into the British aristocracy. They were absolutely amazed by how useless they were. And there's one splendid report of a woman being amazed that her husband, sitting by the fire when it started to go out, would ring a footman to walk miles and miles along corridors to come and poke the fire for him, rather than pick up the fire tongs, which were lying about 4 inches from his foot. It's that sort of that level of practical ineptitude, I think, was a feature, and people used to often remark about on it things like in the army, you know, the officer class were very poorly educated in practical skills,
and therefore they sometimes needed to bring their valets or valets, as you would say, with them into the field.
They didn't. I think that you would have a batman. They were called a service valet is a batman. But it would quite often be someone who had been a manservant in civilian life, mm-hmm. would become a batman. I don't know. I mean, Bates is a very good example of this, because Bates, I think, he's not an officer, mm-hmm. But he's been a batman in the war, and he's shown great courage because it wasn't as if you stayed behind, sort of sewing on buttons. You were in the action, mm-hmm. But he is also, of course, which makes him very equipped for domestic service later in life.
One thing that I think is really fascinating about Downton Abbey is not simply the class divisions between upstairs and downstairs, but the very strict hierarchy among the servants themselves. One that they are, especially those at the upper echelons, are keen to preserve.
Yeah, well, I think the thing about Downton Abbey, or certainly the early series, which are set before the First World War, is that one has to remember that people were just, in general, much more hierarchical. This is not that you have a class of people who are copying the upper class. You know, all classes were hierarchical. There was an assumed hierarchy. It was a world of deference, mm-hmm. and it was a world in which I think, which we would find difficult to understand now, in which there was this exhortation to know your place, you know, that God had given you a place and you didn't strive to go beyond it. Now, that, of course, is a very useful thing to uphold. It was quite often hanging in servants' halls, if you were a member of the upper classes, because the last thing you want is a revolution of working-class people wanting to better themselves. Mm-hmm. But, of course, by the turn of the First World War and after the war, that has changed, and there is a new feeling afoot. The rise of the Labour Party, the rise of the trade unions, and there is a feeling that these distinctions are changing, and that the working class should be given a bite of the apple too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Jane in Dallas. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have a sense of confusion about this whole situation. As I watch Downton, I get the impression that one should have some sort of preparation for a servant position. But if you don't have that, and you're looking for a servant position, how in the world would you prepare yourself or receive training for such a job?
Great question.
Well, I think one of the features about Downton Abbey that I think is not entirely accurate, actually, is the fact that I don't think there are enough servants in the servants' hall. And I can see exactly why there aren't enough. It's because, dramatically, it would be a bit of a mess. We'd be wondering who everyone was all the time. And you need a sort of core... You need a core cast, don't you? But in fact, there would have been... I mean, there's, as far as I can see, there are about two housemaids. There would have been about eight. And in a big house like Downton Abbey, you would go in at a very young age, probably taken from the village or the estate. Your mother would probably have been in service. You know, the villages fed the big house. And you would have started your training by, really, usually, by waiting on the upper servants. And that's not something we see in the program, but that actually would have been how it worked. They would have come in at about 12 or 13, and they'd have started off by learning how to prepare breakfast for the housekeeper and for the butler and so on.
Was there any advantage for servants to have a certain amount of education? It's pretty clear that the people who are running the household are reasonably well educated.
Well, I found conflicting reports of this, actually. So many of your listeners will have read Margaret Powell, who is wonderful on Below Stairs Life, and I think her experiences are quite representative in that many of the houses where she lived, they were looked askance when she asked to borrow books from the library, but in one or two houses they positively encouraged her, and I think that I did find that. I think there's a general fear of the working classes becoming too educated. And there's a lot of fear that reading is spreading information that damages the social structure. You know, that if they read too much, they won't want to be servants anymore. They'll go off and want to be something else. And so that's a sort of part of that general fear. But I think some employers were very generous. And there were lots, actually, that was one of the things I found, that a lot of servants talked about how they discovered the pleasure of reading by being able to experience their employer's libraries.
It didn't hurt to be tall if you wanted to get a good job as a servant.
Well, you pay, you could charge a lot more if you were tall.
Why was that?
Well, I couldn't really understand this. I can see it with footmen. Footmen, I mean, there are lots of advertisements if you look in the Times, right up until the Second World War, of footmen advertising their services and saying, you know, I am over 6 foot.
They're like the hot pool boys of the Downton Abbey world?
They would be. Well, I think I can't remember the name of the footman. Is it Alfred?
Mm-hmm.
The one, he I think, is very well cast because he's enormously tall.
Yeah.
And, of course, a house like Downton could afford a really tall footman. And this was a sort of, it was prestigious. It looked very good. And certainly at Woburn Abbey, which is a vast place, home of the Duke and Duchess of Bedford, in 1930, all their parlourmaids, were over 5'10". Now, I think it would be quite difficult to find a group of people women over 5'10" now, prepared to be parlourmaids. But then, if you can think of the malnourishment of most working class families, the average height was something like 5'1". That was quite a feat.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to John in Richardson. Hey, John.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I are just getting started with the series. In fact, I've just seen the first episode, and I'm drawn to it from, I guess, the storyline, the drama. But at the same time, I was left feeling very uncomfortable with the divisions in the class, how obvious things were, almost like a caste system. Am I supposed to feel that way?
Well, I don't know that Julian Fellowes wants you to feel that way. I mean, certainly caste, I think, is a very good way of putting it, because I don't think, when we think of class now, we tend to think of it in economic terms. But I think, certainly before the First World War, class was regarded as something that was almost set in stone, that it was a sort of, people talk about innate breeding, as though this was something you could never emulate just by being able to buy a big house. You either were born into it or you weren't. And I think that I have a chapter in my book about servants in India. And it was very interesting the way the British Empire used the idea of the British idea of class worked very well in India, where, of course, they had a caste system. And these enormously servanted British Raj households worked very well as a sort of means of display in India, where it was understood very well, the idea of minutely calibrated class structures like that.
What did it take to move up within the ranks of a household?
Well, I think you probably... Well, this isn't always the case, but you quite possibly had to sacrifice the idea of marriage. I can't remember which series it was in Downton Abbey when Mrs. Hughes, an old acquaintance, proposes to her, mm-hmm. and she turns that down because in a rather modern way she's putting her career first, which I thought was an interesting point to make, actually, because in fact it was difficult to be married. It was difficult for Carson or Mrs. Hughes in their positions, or Mrs. Patmore, to be married. It was not completely unknown, but it was difficult. And I think you had to find yourself in a house big enough to be able to be trained up the ladder. If you found yourself stuck, 90% of servants were single-handed maids, in which there was no moving up or moving down. You were just stuck forever where you always were, right, as a maid of all work. And that, I think, there was really no career progression to be had. But if you lived in a house like Downton Abbey, we can see that happening with the little kitchen maid, Daisy. She's learning to be a cook, as Margaret Powell did. She's learning on the job.
How specific were the rules about protecting the privacy of one's employers? How much gossip was tolerated and what could get you fired?
I think gossip was very feared. I found a letter to the Times in about 1911 complaining that the new kind of newspapers, it was the beginning, I think, of sort of gossip columns, were paying servants to gossip about their employers. And I thought that was quite an interesting little, sort of showing a kind of shift of attitude towards sort of privacy and certain kinds of respect. But I think it was very, very frowned upon. I think the level of conversation that you have in Downton Abbey between the servants and the Lord and Lady Grantham, the Crawley family, I think is improbable for that reason.
Yeah, I suppose it serves the narrative, but beyond that.
It serves the narrative, exactly. We have to be constantly reminded that it is a drama.
And the Irish chauffeur would likely not have married the daughter of the manor.
I think that is the most preposterous plot line.
Hmm.
I mean, it's fun.
Yeah.
Not only is he Irish, but he's also, not only is he a servant, but he's Irish, he's Catholic, he's IRA supporter.
He's kind of a revolutionary in all ways.
This is just, you know, when we're just about to have a civil war with Ireland, which is really, really unlikely.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Paul in Plano. Hello, Paul.
Hi. I want to describe a situation. I want to describe my aunt to your guest and see how her situation compares to the people that she's written about. My aunt was from North Carolina. She met this oil man when she was in Washington, D.C. she became a domestic. That is, she was a live-in housekeeper, maid. She basically did everything, I guess, that they needed. Mm-hmm. For probably about 40 years or so. They moved to California. She moved with them. But she had her own property in North Carolina. She had an apartment in Washington, D.C. She had, I guess, the money that they paid her, she saved. But yet she had her expenses taken care of while she was with them most of the year. And I guess she could have stayed with them the whole time, the whole year, but she chose to come home sometimes and just have a vacation, and then she would go back to their place. Wherever they went, she went with them, and she took care of them for probably about 40 years or so. And when she died, the thing I remember about her attitude was that she didn't have a great deal of career aspirations. She was comfortable with who she was. She was very professional at what she did. I remember calling to that house one time, and I almost didn't know who she was by the approach that she took to my call, because it was as though she's on the job, and you know, and she was very careful to mind what she was supposed to be doing on that job. But when she got off the job and she was visiting, she was a very different kind of a person. But she was just a very class act in a lot of ways.
Well, Paul, I so appreciate the story, and we will ask Lucy to compare that with what she learned about servants in Britain in her research after this break. We're speaking this hour with author Lucy Lethbridge. Her new book is called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Lucy Lethbridge. Her new book is called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Lucy, before the break, Paul told us about his aunt who worked as a domestic in the American South. It sounds like in the middle of the 20th century. It sounds like she had a great deal of freedom, which was not something that was that necessarily always characterized service in Britain.
Well, it certainly didn't always characterize it, but I suppose the thing about servants, the idea, the history of servants or service or of any work that takes place in the intimacy of the home, is it is terribly, terribly difficult to draw a sort of composite picture, because everyone's experiences are as different as the personalities involved. What struck me about Paul's account was how how marvelously well organized his aunt was in her life, and that I think is seems to me to be exactly, if we are to have domestic service, that it should look like that, which is a sort of deal. It is given professional dignity. She was a woman who did her job terribly well, and yet retained a degree of independence over her own life, and was not and was not therefore she didn't lose dignity in the job. And I think that seems to me to speak for exactly the best kind of service relationships, and one does find them I encountered one in my researches. It was a little snippet I found in the Museum of London in their taped interviews, and it was a woman saying that she'd gone into service as a very ordinary parlourmaid, she was called Mrs. Mary Ann Mathias, and she was known by her employers. They called her Mary Ann, and she called them Madam and Sir. And then during the Second World War, the sort of social dynamic shifts a bit, and they call her Mrs. Matt, and she calls them Dr. and Mrs. Meir. And then after the war, Mrs. Meir dies, and she and the doctor go on living together for years, her caring for him, by which time she calls him Dick and he calls her Mary.
Hmm.
And I found that very, very touching as a sort of movement, how a relationship can move according to the sort of spirit of both partnerships.
Yeah, it sort of speaks to a change in, again, in that hierarchy and a sense that they were, I suppose, in some ways mutually dependent. She on him for employment, but he on her for that important care.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Jeff in Dallas. Hello, Jeff.
Oh, hello. Well, on the television program about the Downton Abbey, they give an example of the Stamford Hall, which is now a national trust and open to the public. But I was raised in a cottage in Stamford Hall, and I actually worked as a gardener's boy at the tail end of of this era. And the gentleman just called. He said he felt very uncomfortable watching the program. First of all, it's fiction. And even though I worked there as a gardener, worked in that atmosphere as a gardener's boy, I never, ever felt in the least little bit uncomfortable about it. But the class distinction, for want of a better word, survived. This is after World War II. I was working there. And the class distinction survived even after that, I worked for the gardener, and I never even spoke to the owners of the house. I only had contact with the gardener, who was very lucky. He was a very kindly person. And then one little story just to show you how the class distinction did survive. After I quit that job, I worked at another one, and I was doing the same thing as a chauffeur, but I didn't like the job at all. But this was after World War II, and the Labour Party had just been elected. And they just introduced the Social Security national thing. And if you went to work for somebody, they were, by law, they had to accept your National Health Social Security card and put a stamp on it. Well, the job was so bad, I quit. And so the next day I had to go back and collect my card. And the lady of the house, she opened the door just a crack and pushed the card out of the door so she didn't have to make eye contact with me or talk to me or anything. So, it's just one of those things.
I think that's terribly interesting, and I did come across a lot of stories like yours that went on for a surprisingly long time. I suppose things don't change as quickly, perhaps, as history suggests they do, and people who have been brought up before the First World War, with a still living memory, simply could not accept that this new degree of sort of social movement. But how interesting that you actually experienced that life. And do you feel that there are other aspects of Downton that are quite similar to it?
But I mean, it's fiction, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Some things are, and of course, I never worked on a big, huge estate like that. But I will say this one thing about the last Earl of Stamford. He was a wonderful person, and these people, they actually preserved some of these huge estates from the Industrial Revolution. And the Earl of Stamford, even while he was alive, he opened up the estates. Even before World War II, he opened up the estates to the public. He just kept maybe 30 or 40 acres around his home, private, but the rest of the estate he owned up to the public and had public walkways through it. So you know, he was really a very forward-looking person, you know. And
Thank you so much for your call, Jeff. I really appreciate that.
That was very interesting.
Were you able to find a lot of people that you that had had direct experience with this? A lot of the people who were doing this work in its heyday must have be passing on by this point.
Well, when I first started my researches, I advertised in a great many journals and places, and I got a huge correspondence from people. I mean, anyone who had worked before the Second World War was by now pretty old. But if you think, I mean, people went into service at about 13 or 14, mm-hmm. so they would be in their 70s, or that they were then when I started in their 70s, probably now in their 80s. And I was completely fascinated, but people also came forward with letters and correspondence from their parents or their aunts, or there was a wonderful woman in North London who said that she had the diaries of her a great uncle who'd been a footman before the First World War.
Wow.
And I went to see her, and there they all were, and they'd covered in dust, and she'd never read them, and none of her family had ever read them. And I opened them up, and they hadn't, I think, been open since the 1920s. Hmm. And there was his life, you know, his life as a footman on a Scottish estate.
Was there anything in those journals that you couldn't figure out that, you know, he sort of referred to as something that everybody would understand that was puzzling to you?
Well, for me, but this probably is just my ignorance of matters concerning military. He went into the First World War, and in fact, he also was a Batman. He'd been a footman, and he went in as a Batman. Well, he signed up. He volunteered in 1914, and became a Batman. And so there was quite a lot of that, and he talks a lot about a sort of military service, which I didn't go into, military domestic service, one might call it, sort of service of the officer's mess, and I found that quite complicated. but he was very fascinating about the changes. I mean, he didn't know he was being fascinating because he was just writing about life as he saw it, but the changes that the First World War brought about and the resentment that in the 1920s he felt about having to go back to work in service because his attitude had changed. He felt the world was new. He didn't want to go back to wearing livery and being a lackey, really.
It's understandable after you've seen and done so much.
Well, I think so, yes. I think, and certainly he was one who was very politically activated by the experience of the war.
So last night, Lucy, the episode that we saw here in the U.S., we saw Mrs. Patmore receiving this new sort of a gift for the kitchen of an electric mixer and just being outraged by the thing and not quite knowing how it worked. I was interested to read in your book how many people, including people in the middle classes, that really resisted technologies that women in particular in many other parts of the world were delighted to suddenly have access to.
Yes, that was one of the things that I was very interested by, that the level to which, I mean, considering Britain is the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, I mean, we are, domestically, we seem to have been very resistant to new technology and the idea of new technology. And I think part of it was the cult of service.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there's something rather inauthentic about using a mixer when you can get your kitchen maid to sort of, you know, pummel that pastry on with her own hands. And there is, I think this is rotted very deep in the British idea of a sort of authenticity of experience, that somehow machinery gets in the way. It's never quite as good. And that's why I have a chapter in my book on the refugee maids who came over, who were refugees from Nazi-occupied Germany who came over on domestic service permits in the 30s, and they have left some wonderful accounts, I mean, extraordinary accounts of what it's like, I mean, to arrive here from often very well-equipped continental flats where they had electric toasters and central heating, and they'd come here and to find the ordinary British home still had a sort of grate you had to light about 5 hours before it got hot, and people getting up to lay fires, and everything being incredibly, almost willfully arduous.
Why do you think we're so fascinated by this kind of history? I mean, I've tried to understand this in myself, and I don't know. I think I identify more with the servants than with their employers, and yet I suppose it's always fun to fantasize that you have someone to, you know, do your hair three times a day and take care of every possible whim you have.
Yes, I also am very interested in it. And in one of the sort of themes of my book is our continuing fascination with it as a kind of, as a sort of golden age, because, and I think part of it is the idea of a lot of people living together in a kind of constructed harmony. I think this is rather fascinating to us. And that was one thing I thought. And the other thing I think is, of course, although we may identify with the servants, we probably like to think that if suddenly we found ourselves transported to Downton Abbey, we probably would be in the drawing room.
Of course.
I mean, that's what I always think. So although the servants, I think, in the programme are by far the more interesting characters myself, I think the drama that goes on in the servants' hall is far more gripping, the drama of character. But I still, I suppose, if I'm having a fantasy, I don't really want to be the person, you know, lighting the fire. I want to be the person sitting by it.
Yeah. What does service look like today in Britain? I mean, obviously there are still wealthy people, as there are in the United States, that have domestic staff. What are they wearing uniforms today?
Well, I think there is a tiny, tiny little, very wealthy sort of subset. I think there always has been. I mean, enormous wealth, super rich, can afford servants, and certainly. I know that a lot of old-fashioned sort of English servants, I mean, of people prepared to go into that world, can earn enormous amounts. I mean, far, far more than most jobs here could afford by going to work in Russia for the Russian oligarchy and for in China in particular. And you will often see advertised, if you look in the domestic service magazines that we have here, like The Lady, where they advertise, they'll say, English lady's maid wanted. Now, that will not look like Miss O'Brien anymore. It won't be the same kind of lady's maid, but it will be someone who manages the wardrobe of a woman who's jetting around the world, who sees that everything is cleaned, you know, so it's a sort of managerial position, really, which will involve a great deal of competence and organisation.
I think
it does exist, but I think for the most part, and I think this is quite an interesting aspect in Britain at the moment. I think we live in a world suddenly where we have these vast extremes of wealth, rather similar to 1900.
I'm afraid we're out of time. I have to jump in. The new book by Lucy Lethbridge is called Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. Lucy, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.